Welcome to the Thriving Artist Podcast, a feature of the Clark Hewlings Fund for Visual Artists. The Clark Hewlings Fund exists to provide training, introductions, and funding to working artists, to turn working artists into thriving artists. I'm Daniel DeGree, your host. Our guest today is Felicia Van Bork. Felicia is a painter, a printmaker, who specializes in the creation of collages made from her own monotype prints. Influenced by post-impressionism and abstract expressionism, she experiments with color, patterns, and textures to create collages that are landscape-based and playfully destructive. Felicia is also a 2015 Business Accelerator Grant finalist, and you can find her works on Artwork Archive. Welcome to the show, Felicia. We know you're an artist, of course. Can you take a minute to tell us a little bit more in your own words about your background and what you do for a living?
Hi, Daniel. Yes, I am a fine artist. I live near Charlotte, North Carolina, and I was born in Toronto, Canada. I went to the Ontario College of Art and later Mass Art for grad school. My collages are represented by Gerald Melberg Gallery, and I am the printmaking studio manager at the McCall Center for Art and Innovation in Charlotte. I teach drawing and painting at the amazing art program at Central Piedmont Community College. And I'm working on a series of collages called the How-To Series.
Well, now, Felicia, tell us about your collages and your monotype prints. So what are they, and how did they become a prominent feature of your art career?
Well, originally I was a painter, and I still do paint, but most of my work for the past few years has been collage. A few years ago, I went to grad school, and I got in on the strength of my paintings, but I knew I didn't want to do what I had been doing anymore. I was completely at a loss until, well, I had been experimenting. And then the second or third year of grad school, I took a monotype printmaking workshop with Vicky Tomeko. And that one little three-hour introduction just opened the barn door, and the horse ran away. I've been making monotypes like mad ever since. One day, I was looking at my monotypes when they were strewn all over my studio floor, and I noticed that some of the prints just wanted to be together. So I took one of those groupings and built out its intimation into a composition with movement and meaning. I felt a vast feeling of relief because I had somehow finally allowed narrative into my work, and that had been the missing piece for me. When I was in college in my 20s, narrative was a big no-no, but now, even if it still is, I just don't care. The first collage I made that day turned out to be the first one in my How-To series, and now there are about 125 collages, and the series is still going strong.
Well, we're going to be asking you a little bit about that series a little later in the show. But first, you know, you've spent much of your art career as a graphic designer as well as a painter. So did breaking into this new medium, collages and monotypes, did that change the direction of your career and your business goals?
Yes, in a way it did. Only because the collages suddenly got so much more attention. I had already been doing well with selling paintings, especially the more recent series of encaustic paintings. But then when I started making the collages, it just, maybe because I myself was inspired, but the whole thing just took off. And I had a more commercial approach also to exhibiting the work, and that seemed to help a lot.
Now, Felicia, your artist bio says that much of your work focuses on alignment and misalignment. So tell us exactly, what does that mean?
That's an interesting question. Because I'm working with existing images that are torn to pieces, they have linear elements that can or but don't have to align with each other as they are collaged together. And so those alignments and misalignments create larger implied images. And so in that sense, I'm making meaning in a larger way with smaller pieces. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. And for our listeners who want to take a look at that work, of course, you can visit Felicia's profile on our website, or you can visit FeliciaVanBork.com. Felicia, so you've applied for a number of artist residencies and grants, and that included our own. So I wanted to ask you, why did you apply for the Clark Hewlings Fund Business Accelerator Grant?
I applied for this grant because I knew that it was a career-focused grant, and I really wanted to make larger collages, and I thought that that would take or help take my career to the next level, especially because one of my collages had just been acquired by a museum, and it really made me aware of the potential for exhibiting in larger spaces. So I looked at the prices of the panels that I work on above the size that I had been working, and those larger ones were just way beyond my budget. So I really needed the grant. As it happened, I didn't get the grant, and so I couldn't order the panels. And that made me receptive to a recent commission to make a large painting on canvas. And now I'm in the middle of that painting, and I'm loving it, and it's based on a small collage. So you never know where life will take your art.
Now, you mentioned that you didn't receive the grant, and it's true. You were one of the finalists, and of course, we get far more applicants than we can possibly award. But, you know, we usually don't send people away empty-handed. And so one of the things we did was invite you to join the Business Accelerator Workshop Program. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about your experiences so far in that program.
Well, a fun thing about it being in the development stage of a workshop program like this is that the feedback from the artists is included in the program so that future sessions are actually built around the questions that the artists have, which makes the sessions very relevant to the artists. They certainly have been relevant to me.
That's good to know. You know, it's true. I know you're referring to, of course, the fact that the program is a pilot program for 2016. And yet, this process of including the artists collaboratively in shaping each of the upcoming workshops and solving the problems the artists want to solve for their business, that's actually a core value of the program, something that we plan to keep working at in one form or another, regardless. So I'm sure that we'll have some standing courses, et cetera, but I think they will constantly evolve as artists continue to bring us the problems they want to solve. So let me ask you this, one more question about the Business Accelerator Program. What's one thing that you have learned through the program that you're glad you did?
I've actually learned some very practical tips on making use of hidden features of networking software like Facebook that I wasn't aware of at all, and they could make a significant difference.
So that's good, social media marketing and growing your business through digital marketing. So let me ask you a little bit more about your unique sort of work product. Now, you've gained national recognition primarily for your collages, but you know, you also paint and draw. So tell me this, do you feel limited, Felicia, by that success in a single medium, and also by the fact that your gallery only represents a portion of your work?
Actually, I think it may be a freedom. Having the gallery represent one part of my work allows me to be a little more flexible with the other work while at the same time being steadily productive with something I know that I can move out of the studio in a regular way. Does that make sense? I'm flexible and yet also in a stable situation at the same time.
Oh, I think it does. It's sort of like the old adage, don't quit your day job, use it to fund your passion, right? So in some way, I'm not saying that's an exact analogy, but in some ways you're saying that having representation for one type of work gives you the freedom to kind of explore direction you may not have the freedom to explore otherwise with your other work. So let me ask you this. So how do you market and sell the works that you're not known for, that are not, you know, fully represented?
That is an issue that I am still working on. Sometimes collectors of my collages will ask me if I do any other kinds of work and will ask to see examples of my collages in addition. Like, they'll want to see the new collages, but they will also want to see drawings, for example, figure drawings and portraits and paintings, landscape paintings, works that are still left from previous series. And so the fact that I'm known because of the efforts of the gallery helps me promote the rest of my work as well.
Well, I love, Felicia, that you're calling out not just the other type of work that you do, but even the materials and the process pieces and the derivative works and other things around your process. There's an adage that Elizabeth Hewlings, the head of our fund, likes to use, which is "Don't throw anything away." So it's really in a nice position to be in that stuff is being valued. So do you monetize your works beyond what the gallery does, you know, sort of independently then? Do you sell work independently of the gallery in addition to the gallery's efforts?
Yes, when the opportunity arises, I do. For example, right now I'm working on a commission painting that I'm selling independently.
How do you go about that? Felicia, how do you create sort of a direct relationship with the buyer? And I'm curious too, is this a B2B or a B2C? Are you selling to an individual or to a business or organization?
I'm selling to an individual. How does it come about? These things happen very organically. I make a big effort to be visible and available and in touch with a lot of people who are interested in art in general, especially in my region. So I attend a lot of art events in Charlotte, and I'm very active in showing examples of my work on various social media platforms. And that way, people are attracted to the work.
And do you maintain an email mailing list as well?
I do.
So how has that worked out for you? Is it a pretty successful way to augment having to sort of attend the events in person to network? Is it a networking tool, or what's been the response so far?
There is a very good response when I send out a mass email about an upcoming show, but usually that email is complementing the mailings that are sent out by the gallery. It helps to reinforce the gallery's efforts, and that is good because my efforts are more personal in a sense. So I'm directing my emails to people whom I know or who have collected my work. And so it's just that added personal contact.
Well, it's really refreshing to hear that you're doing, you know, contact management and maintaining your audience through email. Of course, combined with events and social media, that's really a killer combination for artist marketing and for audience growth, and precisely what you're talking about, you know, developing an independent audience so that you can actually sell work independently of your gallery and even maybe works that the gallery doesn't represent. So let me ask you a related but different question. You know, you're working on work that you love and are passionate about that's separate from what your gallery represents, but do you create works of art that you know in advance won't be sold?
It's true that there are works whose subject matter is dark or difficult and which I think, oh, this one will not sell. But I just cannot predict really what will sell because some of these darker ones do. They fly out the door. So I guess I'm just not a good judge.
Well, I like the darker stuff. One of the complaints I hear about the art on my walls is, wow, that's dark. And I'm like, yeah, but you're only looking at one wall. Turn your head to the other direction and look at my bright wall. But yeah, so there's someone for everything that gets created, perhaps, you know. Well, let me ask you this then. How have you crafted or developed a unique personal brand with your collages?
The uniqueness of my brand is something that I actually don't worry about. I think it just happens naturally, and I think many artists are, technically, they are inventors, so they're forever creating a new technique without even worrying that it will help them with the marketing of their work. It just arises naturally. So with my collages, I was making them on paper for a long time, and then I just became tired of seeing them displayed behind glass. So then I experimented with making them on braced panels, and that produced an object that was much more substantial. It was a whole different quality. And then I realized, well, I can't market that without glass unless I varnish it. And so I had to do a lot of experimentation with varnishes that would still produce the quality of the paper that I loved and not give a plasticky coating to the work. And this has worked out for me. I have developed a good formula, and the collages now sell on these braced panels without glass.
I'm just curious, can I ask you a really sort of geeky technical question, Felicia, about your varnishing?
Sure.
Well, I'm curious, you know, how do you think about sort of the longevity of the art when you select a varnish or other materials when you're making these collages? Do you worry about how long they will last without fading or without separation or other things, you know, that often will happen to various multimedia works?
Yes, I'm a ridiculously conscientious person, and that's just my own fault, but it results in my being very, very careful about the archival qualities of my work. Occasionally, I've had a disaster with a piece, and that has steered me in a new direction that makes the work better.
Well, I ask you that, I guess maybe one follow-up question. You know, you put this thought into your work, thought that maybe even the purchaser of the work hasn't necessarily thought about, right? When you talk about being vocal or present in social media, do you reveal that effort and that thinking to your potential audience? Do you tell the story of your process?
I don't know that I do. It does come up among artists when they ask questions on Facebook, for example, like what adhesive do you use or how do you varnish and that kind of thing. It becomes public knowledge then. I always share everything because I think artists should. But I'm not sure that I make a special effort to brag about the fact that I use the very best paper and the very best ink and the very most archival adhesives, and maybe I should.
Well, I don't know. I don't know if, you know, I'm not a visual artist, but I collect art. I'm a very recent sort of wet behind the ears collector, but I do it. And I love it when the artists geek out, because I'm not another painter, but if anything they can tell me about their process enhances the ownership of the art for me, you know, anything that they can tell me about, you know, what they used or what they were thinking or any funny stories about or how it came about or anything that's involved in their process, I memorize all of that stuff. I tell other people about it in Facebook. I display the art and I share it and I'm like, okay, so this is what my artist was doing. You know? I love that stuff. So yeah, I was just curious because you strike me as a person who does put a lot of fine thought into what she produces. You produce an excellent work product. So let me ask you a couple more questions about this, and then we'll kind of shift gears to sort of more of the business side of it as well. So I want to ask you, you know, you're obviously creating, and earlier you said, well, I try not to think about it too much, you know, the building of a personal brand. You create what you love, but how do you balance creating what you love with what will also sell? Do you find yourself bending to the market or pulling away from the market? And I think while I get that everybody does a little bit of both, how do you navigate it? What is your solution to this market versus muse conundrum?
There are many facets to the answer to that question. I do not change my art to cater to what might sell, or at least I try not to. But I have to say that originally when I got all this attention for my collages, I did have a very commercial attitude. I knew that I would have an exhibition opportunity within the context of a residency at the McCall Center for Art and Innovation. And I wanted to experiment with marketability. And so what I did was I deliberately chose a frame before making the art. I chose an IKEA frame that was an unusually well-built one for them and had a square opening that I liked. And then I made a large number of collages that I loved to fit that size. And then when I exhibited them, there were rows and rows of beautifully framed, ready to hang, colorful and attractive collages. And I did this because for myself, I find that if I'm confronted with a row of identically sized attractive artworks, I cannot help but go into this, which one is my favorite mode. And it is a very small step from choosing your favorite to adopting the puppy in the litter that you think is the cutest. And that worked very well for me. I sold many collages. And I also made sure that the prices were not ridiculously high. And that helped a lot, too.
Well, I love that it sounds like you carried something really valuable from your background in commercial art and in graphic design over to the business of fine art, because, you know, you did experiment with, you know, what could I do if I focused on wanting to make some money and sell something? You changed your process a little bit, and I find that fascinating. And you're not alone, of course. I read an article recently that was saying, who are the new Damien Hirsts, right? And it's a little bit cynical in that sense that it's saying, well, which artist do you want to buy if you're trying to recoup your financial investment? And that's not why I buy art. But what I found funny about it is that one of the artists they mentioned is somebody whose art I'm very interested in, and it's Bobby Russon, Russon. I'm probably mispronouncing the name. His work I don't even know who it is. I just know the work, right? This work is, the frames are very important. There are a lot of miniature paintings in these special frames. So there's a similarity there where other people are sort of thinking like that, you know, about the marketability of it. That what you're buying is kind of a complete package, a complete experience, and even a connection with the artist. So I commend your savviness. I think that's really smart. Let me ask you then, has this blending of media, has it positively impacted your career? Has it been a challenge? Do you find that mixed media work is a challenge to do some people sort of write it off, or does it limit your market? And what advice do you have for other mixed media artists or blended media artists?
Well, going back to a previous comment that you made about geeking out about your process, my gallery does pretty intensively grill me about my process so that they can tell these anecdotes about the work to potential buyers. I myself am perhaps the world's greatest killer of sales because I know the story behind the artwork. And if I reveal my content, it supplants what the viewer brings to the work. And that can lessen their interest in it. If they see their grandmother's cottage in my abstract landscape and I take that away from them, they will move on to something else. But somehow my gallery is really good at not removing the cottage that they see. So that is good. And also with mixed media, as with any artwork, I think having it properly framed is of great help to selling. I think 90% of my sales have been of work that has been framed and ready to hang. It's like buying a piece of furniture. Although you can assemble your own furniture, you're more likely to buy something that you can just sit on right away.
Yeah, I want a car that I can drive off the lot. It sort of breaks my heart dropping it off at the framers for 2 weeks and waiting, you know, sight unseen and not having the immediate enjoyment, especially if you're buying directly from the artist or you're literally walking out of a gallery. You want to be able to do it. One more question about this. It seems like the mixed media work is becoming the new thing. It's incredibly popular in some circles. You know, almost everybody is doing one sort of either cross media or mixed media or experimenting with a secondary media. Do you find that means there's more competition and it's harder for you to sort of carve out a niche?
You can look at it another way and say that you can profit by association. So if you're doing something that's popular and you're exhibiting with other people who are doing something related, then you're attracting potential buyers who are already interested in that kind of process. So I wouldn't see it as a negative at all.
Well, so I lied when I said only one more question about this, because some of these questions, they're not scripted, people. We come up with this, a lot of these things as we're just having a real conversation. So you're sort of getting the real deal. And Felicia has no idea what we're going to ask her.
No.
Which is part of the fun. Welcome to the hot seat, Felicia. But I wanted to ask you, do you go to art fairs? How do you feel about art fairs?
Oh, gosh, they're wonderful. I'm very grateful that my gallery brings my work to a national and international audience that I cannot reach. And they do it by taking my work to art fairs like Art Miami or the art fairs in New York, art fairs in Dallas. When I can, I go to the art fair to see how it looks, to see my work, and to see what the responses are to it. It's a very different way of seeing my work because it is unrelated to the creative process and much more related to sales and glamour and a high-end way of looking at work that isn't particularly conducive to my process. But it's interesting nonetheless.
So I can almost hear in your answer, that's a wonderful enthusiasm, and I can almost still hear, though, some of that eye that belongs to the graphic designer that is shifting the context of where the work appears sort of mentally and looking at it differently, rotating that puzzle. So let me ask you about, let's switch gears and kind of talk about the career side of things. Why did you stop working in graphic design in the beginning?
I stopped working in graphic design because a gallery owner saw my work and said something nice about my art. And that was just the little bit of encouragement I needed to take the plunge.
Wow. So it really a word of encouragement goes a long way. That's fantastic. I have another question I want to ask you about this. Maybe I can put you on the hot seat just for fun. Before I do that, I just want to mention to our audience, the Clark Hulings Fund delivers podcast courses like this at the pleasure of our audience. And that means if you're finding value in what you're hearing, a gift of $15 per month would be welcome and an appropriate way to sponsor this show's ongoing broadcast. Please know also that a portion of our funding goes to deliver direct education to artists who've demonstrated a clear, achievable plan for transforming their businesses into self-sustaining and thriving ones that fill the world with art. Share this commitment with us now at clarkhulingsfund.org/thrive. That's clarkhulingsfund.org/thrive. We'd certainly appreciate it. Now, Felicia, the question I want to ask you is, what emotional tools are required to leave behind a steady job and pursue a full-time art career?
Well, you could say insanity is a requirement, or a husband with a steady job. And I'm very fortunate to have a big dose of the latter and not such a big dose of the former. My husband is a professor at a good college, and he has a steady income that allows me to have fluctuations in my income.
Well, so in terms of the courage it takes or the other sort of emotional skill sets it might require, what would you say to the barista artist who is looking to take the plunge, dump the day job, and give it their all in full-time art?
I think I would say don't give up your day job until you have some indication that your work will sell. Otherwise, you might starve. I'm sorry, that sounds rather harsh.
I think that's very candid, you know. In any other field, why would it be different in art, I wonder? Because in any other field, we would say the same thing, right? If we said, if somebody said, I want to go be a competitive NASCAR driver. Yeah, that's a possible career choice, but you might want to have some indication that you're going to be successful as a race car driver in general before you go do that, right?
Right.
Well, you teach a class every semester, and you mentioned it earlier, Central Piedmont Community College. Now, this is teaching artists. Does teaching alter the way that you interpret either your art or your art as a business?
Yes. Teaching, I find, is a gold mine. Sometimes I'll invent an exercise that will lead to a whole series of new artworks for me, or vice versa, I'll make an artwork that leads to a series of exercises that enrich the experience of my students. For example, I was drawing color grids, which are oil pastel pictures, and those led to a great exercise to help my painting students understand the effects of light on local color. And then I did an exercise to draw a portrait from life in only 20 strokes, and the students hated it, but it led to a series of paintings for me. So not only does teaching keep my fundamental skills sharp, it also helps me articulate my thoughts. It also balances the solitude of the studio by giving me a socially gratifying experience.
I'm going to ask you in a moment about that series, but first, just one more question about sort of career choices and teaching, and then we'll sort of shift gears to marketing and how you've pursued a rather unique and interesting trajectory. Why take the time to teach? You know, you could dedicate that time to just your craft Is it the money? Is it the supplemental income? Is that your sort of barista work? Or are you teaching for those reasons that you just mentioned? Or is there something else that's driving you to do this in addition to producing fine art?
At this stage in my career, I can make as much money from selling art as from teaching that same amount of time. But teaching gives me contact with new ideas that are very valuable. It does balance the solitude of the studio, and it also keeps me in touch with the faculty at the school, and I find that very valuable also, because that's a form of networking.
Well, now, let me then ask you about the series and the project that you were talking about. You do some demonstration events, and that came about, you told a story once to me privately about how you created this demonstration with your students and went on to pursue it even farther. And, you know, you take the show on the road, so to speak. Can you tell us a little bit about what I'm talking about?
Yes. The exercise was that 20-stroke portrait painting exercise, which originally was a 40-stroke painting. And my idea was that once I load up my brush and place it on the canvas, I'm not allowed to lift it from the canvas until I have completed a stroke, however long or short that needs to be. You can really paint a whole head, not in detail, but in a single stroke. At least you can get the ears and the shape of the head on. And so I thought my students would learn a lot about making good choices about color value and hue if they would do this exercise. But they found that it was too much pressure to do a good likeness in only 40 strokes from life. I recklessly offered to do this exercise myself for a fundraiser at the school. And when they were making the sign to advertise it, they changed it from 40 strokes to 20 strokes. So I was suddenly committed to painting these portraits from life in 20 strokes. And it got quite a bit of attention and led me to wish to go on making these 20-stroke portraits.
That's hilarious. A minor clerical error, and suddenly your work got exponentially more difficult.
It did.
That's fantastic. Well, you do, you know, demonstration events, as we said, and you put the videos on YouTube. Are these, can we see some of that in your YouTube channel as well?
I have not yet made a video of the 20-stroke portrait, but that is something I've been thinking about. The videos currently online are of me demonstrating how I make a collage.
Well, let me ask you about the videos that you do have. You know, as you say, they show your technique and your process, but why do you do those demonstrations on video?
Well, that was organized by the gallery. So they asked me if I would like to, and I said, sure. And I think it was to promote the gallery, but in the process, it also very much promoted me and my work. I do have another video that I made myself that is of how to make giant tissue paper flowers. And those flowers I invented to complement an exhibit of my prints. And people were so much more interested in the flowers than the prints at that show that I got very tired of explaining how I made the flowers. So I made the video so I could tell people, just watch the video.
I have made that video. I've made many videos because I keep answering the same question. So I know exactly what you're talking about. Well, do you know what the impact has been? How have creating those videos altered the results for your marketing? Have they been a positive impact, et cetera?
I actually don't know. I have had many, many responses to the flower making video with online messages to that YouTube channel, and it's lovely because I get messages in Russian and Hindi and all kinds of languages, and I have to translate them and answer them, and I try to answer them in the language in which they came, just for fun. But I really don't know what impact any of this is having on my career. I don't know the impact of the hits on my other videos either.
Well, that's interesting. You know, that is something that artists struggle with when the marketing is operated by the gallery. Sometimes there's an opacity there and you're not really sure what the impact is. But it's a good thing to manage and monitor, because it suggests, you know, the beauty of these videos is you are the driver. They can't be done without you. Everybody else can fail to show up, but you're the person. So I'd be interested in what the impact is, because I'm fascinated by how artists attempt to grow their marketing through these kinds of demonstrations. So Felicia, these demonstrations, as you say, you know, they're hosted by the gallery, and actually they occur in galleries. Do you have any advice for how gallerists can plan for these kinds of demonstrations, and more importantly, how can they make them successful? Any tips or insights there?
Are you speaking of recording the demonstrations or how to stage them?
Probably both, because I do think there are galleries that aren't doing this kind of thing yet. There's a place I go upstate that is it's a town that's full of art galleries. It's known for it, and I would say they're very traditional. There isn't a lot of this kind of video demonstration marketing going on. So I'm curious if there's anything you've come to the conclusion this is how you do it right, and maybe you could give an insider to gallerists who are listening.
When the videographer was there shooting my demonstration, I think he had at least one assistant with him. So he was the cameraman, and somebody else was in control, making sure that the lighting and the sound were good. So that was impressive to me, that there was such a professional approach to making the video. The gallery had organized things so that I had a wall behind me with my own artwork exhibited, but also a table in front of me so that I could show my materials and demonstrate how I work with them. And then beyond that, there was the audience seated on sort of casual seating and standing. And the camera would not only focus on me, but when there were questions, would also pan around the audience or occasionally cut to a picture of an artwork that was relevant to what I was saying at that moment. So it was a well-produced video, which responded to that desire of collectors and people who are interested in art to know about the process.
So that's good insight. First, think about do a quality video if you're going to do this. Think about potentially multiple cameras. Definitely think about lighting. Another is think about the branding and the context. So they had your art on the walls in the background. They thought about the sort of total context. And then think about the audience and include them. Don't just make it a one-sided video. So that's all good insight. I'll just ask you one more question about this, and then we'll sort of wind up the show with a few questions that are just straight up business questions. So how are doing these demonstrations for other people's benefit different than teaching as you do in a college?
They are very similar. Doing a demonstration of the kind that you're discussing is more like giving a lecture, and doing a demonstration where there's participation from the audience or the students is more like a typical studio classroom experience. But in both cases, the participants are learning technical information about the production of an actual artwork.
Now, Felicia, you've received a number of awards and you've participated in numerous residencies, as do many artists, of course. But why should artists actually bother with residencies if they're already successful?
Yes, it can be very tempting to stay holed up in your studio. If you have a nice studio, why would you go to a residency somewhere far away and go to all the trouble of packing up all your materials? But I am about to go to one for a month, and I'm delighted because I will be there with 20 artists I've never met before, or at least 15, and maybe I have met a few of them before. And these will be very valuable new contacts, and probably some of them will become friends for life. For adults who are no longer in elementary school and high school, it is not so easy to find people to be friends for life and find kindred spirits.
You know, this is very similar to what you said about why you teach. You're constantly sort of pouring things in the hopper that stir up your imagination and diversify your contacts and the sort of data points and inputs and stimulations that you have. And it sounds like you conclude that those things are really important to producing good art, but also to keeping you on your toes with running an art business.
Yes, it keeps me lively in both senses.
Well, I want to ask, isn't the goal simply to sort of get solid representation and just make art from now on for the rest of your life? And if so, why bother pushing the boundaries of your artwork if you're already seeing a measure of success with it?
Why bother? Because you want to be a better artist. You always want to be better and better and better at what you do. And you want to share it with more and more people. So you cannot just sit and be content with the situation that you have arrived at.
If that's the case, and you're not ever really content, then where do you see yourself in, say, 10 years, Felicia?
I see my work being exhibited with more galleries and perhaps in other countries. Since I have connections to other countries just because of my family, it would be nice to have some work being shown in Europe. It would be lovely to be in a situation where I have some assistance in the production of my work so that I can focus more on the purely creative part of it and less on the technical manual labor.
So one more question about the business end of things. What would you like to, at the end of your career, what would you like to have achieved with your art as a business? What's the end goal?
With my art as a business, my goal is really to share the good parts of what I have accomplished so that others can benefit from it. And I always imagine that my epitaph ideally would say something like, she guided a few people to the right path, or their own path. And that really is my goal. And if that means that I have to win big awards and show in big museums, then that's what it will be.
Well, I really like that answer. So now I think we'll wind it up with just a couple of fun questions. It's been a little bit intense, and it's been such a great show, Felicia. I want to ask you, from the time you first started, if you knew then what you know now, and you could go back in time and do one thing differently, what would that thing be?
I would have gone to a better school.
Wow. And when you say better, what do you mean?
School is very important for making connections to gifted people and encourage and help you along your path. And as a teacher, I see how important it is to have those connections. In retrospect, I wish that I had been encouraged to apply to schools like Yale, for example, which at the time that I went to college was producing some very exciting artists. Whether I would have gotten in or not is a good question, but I should have at least have applied.
I'm with you there. I have one last question, and it's sort of the opposite of that one. That was from the past into the present. This one's from the present into the future. So if you could have one technology or one superpower to do something that you're just currently not able to do with your art and career, what would you choose?
I had a superpower. I already have incredible superpowers, so what would I add to those?
And I know you don't mean you go out at night and fight crime.
Yes. Well, this will sound terrible, but if I could have a superpower, I would abolish sexism and racism so that I wouldn't be held back by, in my case, sexism.
Wow. So we can't just end on that note. I have to know what holds you back, really? What is it exactly that you're referring to? I don't mean you have to give us too much detail, but I mean, when you say that sexism and racism and other things hold you back, what is it? What is that?
The number of women artists represented by major museums is still abominably small, and the number of women entering art programs is well over half the student body, so there is a serious disparity. I just wish that that were a thing of the past.
Wow, that's so odd. So that's still true even today, and you think it's systematic. I'm so surprised. You know, I was talking about Bobbi Rassun earlier. It is a she. And, you know, her work's fantastic. But while I feel silly and stupid for not getting to know more about the artist and just gawking at the work, you know, because I just sort of fell in love with it recently, I never think about whether it's a male or female. It doesn't occur to me that that matters. But you're saying that to someone somewhere, it still matters somehow. That's so odd.
If you were in a museum, I'm sorry, if you were in a museum looking at Paul Klee's painting of a cat's face, and you went and read the little sign, and the sign said that the painting was by someone named Cindy Clark, that would affect you differently than if you knew that it were by Paul Klee. Everybody is biased by both celebrity and gender, and also by race. It's unfortunate.
I don't know. This is why I guess I'm such a barbarian when it comes to art. I go storming around the gallery and deciding what I like, and I don't really care that much. I mean, I recognize certain things. I'm like, I think that's a Magritte over there, but you know, I don't really, and I like that, you know, but I don't really, and I'm like,
I love that you storm around.
yeah, I break the rules. I try to get into the roped off areas, things like that. I'm like, why is this area roped off? Is that where the good art is? Where are you not letting us in? Well, we don't have enough security. So how do you determine what's the higher priority? Well, that one's harder to guard. So that's where the good art is. Let me in there. It's a fun thing to go to the Museum of Fine Art and be a barbarian because you can just kind of berserk in there. Well, it's really been a fun show, Felicia. It's just been fantastic having you. You've been listening to the Thriving Artist Podcast, a feature of the Clark Ewlings Fund for Visual Artists. For more information on Felicia Van Bork, visit FeliciaVanBork.com. For more information on the Clark Ewlings Fund, visit ClarkEwlingsFund.org. And be sure and follow our podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Thank you for listening, and thank you, Felicia. It really has been great having you.
Thank you.